Acknowledgement of Country. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, work and study on, the Awabakal people. I extend that acknowledgement to the land on which our listeners meet on. I pay my respect to elders past, present and emerging. Listener discretion is advised. The topics we discuss in this podcast may cause distress to some. If at any point you feel confronted, please contact Lifeline or utilise the university's free counselling service. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Espresso Warriors Katara. Welcome back to the UON CRIM podcast. I'm your host, Isabella Krebet, and in today's episode, we're investigating eyewitness memory, and I'm joined by expert in the field, Hayley Cullen. Hayley, how are you? Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you. So, Hayley, you're new to UON.
Very new.
Yeah, awesome.
Still working out how to get into this building, but
new. What do you teach here?
So I'm an associate lecturer in psychology. So I'm teaching CRIM 2020 for this semester and then developing some content for psychology units for next semester.
Yeah, terrific. And what are your qualifications?
So I recently submitted my PhD in December last year, which was quite the experience. For the last 6 or 7 years, I've been working in the field of eyewitness memory. So I've been conducting research since my honours year. And I've taught a lot of courses in forensic psychology and just general psychology.
Congratulations on your PhD. That's excellent.
Thank you.
And how did you get interested in this area?
So in high school, I was always interested in the law. And coming out of high school, to get into a law degree is incredibly difficult, as I'm sure many people know. So I was thinking about what kind of subjects I could do at uni to eventually move into law and to do a law degree. And my auntie said, you know, why don't you try psychology? Because it's, you know, when you're working in the law, you have to have an understanding of people and, you know, how to interact with people. And so I went to Sydney Uni, I did sociolegal studies and psychology together, and realized that I really loved psychology by chance, but didn't like as much the sociolegal theory. So I moved into the psychology area. And then in my first year of undergraduate, I was exposed to forensic psychology as a course, and that was just the right move for me. So I did my honours research in forensic psychology, and I just kept going from there and still in the field now.
That's one of the great parts about uni, is just like thinking that you're interested in something and then discovering that there's a whole other side to it.
Exactly. I think a lot of students, especially coming out of high school, you don't quite know where you're going to go, and that's okay. That's all part of the process, because a lot of the time you find the area for you just by chance.
Yeah.
So for anyone listening that's not sure where you want to go, that's okay, you will find it.
That's excellent advice. So you focus on eyewitness memory.
Yeah.
What is an eyewitness?
So an eyewitness, I mean, in the general sense, is someone who's witnessed a crime. You can have ear witnesses as well, so people who might not have seen what happened but can provide some description of, you know, something that they heard. It could be, you know, a telephone conversation, but an eyewitness is someone who's observed an event. It doesn't have to be a criminal event. It could be, you know, you can have eyewitnesses to car accidents, for example, when there's no crime that's occurred. But generally speaking, just an observer of something that they might later have to report on.
What's their role in a crime, investigating a crime, for example?
Yeah, they have a really important role, because I guess the conception is when a crime occurs that there's going to be lots of different types of evidence. You know, we watch CSI, we watch all those shows, we think that there's going to be all these great, you know, types of forensic evidence. But actually, when most crimes occur, usually the only evidence is an eyewitness or someone who could provide corroborating information. So they do play a really important role, because they might be the only type of evidence that we have.
So what do they do? Are they involved in the lineup process?
They are involved in lineup. So there's, I guess when we're thinking of eyewitness memory, there's two kind of main types. Mm-hmm. There's identification memory, which is the lineup procedure. Mm-hmm. So that's getting witnesses to identify something from the scene of the crime. It could be the perpetrator, so in a lineup. It could also be something like a weapon. They might be shown different objects that they have to identify as well. So identification memory is basically just whether what you're seeing in front of you currently matches what you saw at the scene. So you're trying to identify something that's in front of you as being something that you saw. Recall memory is the other type of memory. So this is when we're getting witnesses to describe events. So questions like, can you tell me what happened? What did the perpetrator look like? That's tapping into a slightly different type of memory, which is much more descriptive in nature.
So why do people use eyewitnesses?
Well, like I said before, they are often the most common form of evidence available. Mm-hmm. But despite some issues with eyewitness memory, for the most part, if we do the right things and we make sure that the procedures are evidence-based, then they can actually be really accurate.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't just assume they're not going to be accurate, but there's things we can do to make sure that the evidence is reliable.
Mm, what makes them reliable?
Lots of things. So there's research that suggests that there's kind of two key factors that affect eyewitness memory. They're called estimator and system variables. And just to make that a bit clearer, estimator variables are things that might happen at the crime scene. So there might be, things about the witness themselves, so the age of the witness, the amount of stress that they're under, but they could also be things about the crime. So, the lighting conditions, whether the perpetrator's wearing a disguise, those kind of event characteristics that we can't do anything about them, we can't prevent them from happening. It's, once a crime happens, it's happened, but they do impact upon memory. So, for example, lighting conditions, you can imagine that if a crime happens at, midnight compared to, 9 a.m., that you're probably going to remember it better if it happened at 9 a.m. when it's light. So they're estimator variables. System variables, on the other hand, are things that are in control of the legal system, and these relate to the procedures that, police officers or lawyers might put in place when they're collecting the evidence. So the type of questions police ask, how they administer a lineup procedure, they're examples of things that can impact upon memory and are good in a way that we can control them. So we can do something about them and improve the eyewitness's reliability.
And what makes them unreliable?
So I guess the key thing that affects eyewitness reliability is the way the evidence is collected. That's a really big factor. So that's what a lot of the research focuses on, is those system variables. So this kind of stemmed from the fact that there's some historical research that shows that the way you ask questions can affect eyewitness memory. If you ask really leading and suggestive questions, witnesses will go along with those suggestions and they might produce inaccurate accounts. So, for example, if a police officer asks something like, was there broken glass at the scene of the crime? You've suggested that there was broken glass. You're more likely to get a false detail reporting there. So something like the type of questions that are asked, the way police conduct lineups, if, for example, the police officers know who the suspect in the lineup is, they might bias the witness intentionally or not, and just other forms of police procedure can have a really big impact.
Mm. So within the lineup, what can lead an eyewitness to misidentifying a suspect?
Yeah, there's a number of different factors. So actually a paper came out last year which was produced by the American Psychology Law Society. And they identified that when conducting lineups, there's kind of 9 big factors that can affect eyewitnesses' identification accuracy. So like I said just before, making sure that the police officer doesn't know who the suspect is, that's a big thing. Another thing is just making sure everyone in the lineup is similar so that you don't have your suspect being completely different in terms of appearance. That's going to be a big problem if they stand out. Other factors is just making sure that you have an evidence-based suspicion, so you're not putting someone in a lineup just for the sake of it, that you've got pretty good grounds to do it. Making sure that when you ask the witness how confident they are in their identification, that you do it immediately. because what can happen is confidence can increase over time. So we start to become more confident when we get feedback that we've done a good job. It's kind of like when you have exams in school and you're told that you've done well, you're going to be more confident over time. Another factor is the instructions that witnesses are given. So they should be told that the suspect might not be the perpetrator, because if they're not told that, they tend to just select someone because they feel like they have to. So that's a big thing, is just making sure the instructions are not biasing witnesses to choose. What haven't I said yet? I said there was 9. I've said 4 or 5. There's a few other ones that are, you know, the research is not as well established, but there's still reasonably good evidence. So making sure the procedure's videotaped, you know, making sure that you only have a witness completing one identification parade and not multiple different ones, because that will affect who they pick and who looks familiar to them. And yeah, just those kind of procedures are all really important.
What is reconstructive memory?
So reconstructive memory is how, well, when we think of, I guess I'll start by thinking most people who don't know much about memory think that memory works like a video camera. So they can, you know, once they've witnessed an event, they can replay it in their minds, press play, and that they'll see the event as it happened. And that's the assumption that memory is a reproduction, which it's not. It is reconstructive. So what that means is that every time we go to remember something, we have to piece together all of the different parts of the memory. So all of the different things we saw, all of the different sounds, and we have to put all that back together and reconstruct it. So what that means through that reconstructive process is that each time we tell somebody something that we witnessed, the way we tell it might be slightly different because of that reconstruction process. There might be some small differences in what we remember. Other times those differences could be quite substantial, and that's just all a part of how memory works.
What is weapon focus?
Good question. So weapon focus is, well, imagine that you've witnessed a crime and you're the victim and you have someone right in front of you holding a weapon at your face. The key thing that you're going to look at in that scene is the weapon, because it's striking, it's threatening, it's unusual as well. So weapon focus is when witnesses, when there is a weapon in the scene, they focus all of their attention on the weapon, and it kind of creates a tunnel visioning. So they only really process the weapon, and they don't process other details in the scene, like they might not even remember the perpetrator's face or might not be able to identify the perpetrator. And the weapon focus effect could, you know, there's a different accounts of why it happens. Some accounts are that weapons are threatening, so naturally we have this threat superiority where we focus on threatening objects. There's other theories that say that it's more because a weapon is usually unusual. We're not expecting to see it. So it could be because it's it doesn't fit within our expectations of the world. So there's different theories.
So can you tell us a bit about investigative interviewing and the role that the eyewitness plays in that?
Yeah, so when a crime happens, when we're getting witnesses to come forward and give information, it's often in the context of an investigative interview. So it goes back to recall memory, which I was talking about before. So police often get formal statements from witnesses. And investigative interviewing is based on the premise of the cognitive interview, which is a guideline for how we should be collecting witness evidence. So the cognitive interview talks through what the social environment should look like. So making sure that you know, the setting is comfortable for the witness, but also making sure that the interviewer is building rapport with the witness, making them feel comfortable, making sure that there's an element of trust there. And then the guidelines for how to engage in this cognitive interviewing is to just make sure that you don't ask leading or suggestive questions, that you try to ask open-ended questions. So rather than me asking you to describe the perpetrator's eyes, I might say, "Could you tell me what the perpetrator looks like?" So to keep it as general as possible, and to not ask yes or no kind of questions. So this investigative interviewing is really important because a lot of the time, at least in Australia, that's one of the main ways that police get evidence from witnesses, is through a formal police statement with those techniques.
Before we get into some questions about your research, Hayley, what's your go-to coffee order?
Ooh, okay. I never get the same thing every time. I love a good hot chocolate. I love a chai latte, but the caffeine content, not great. So I've started to get vanilla lattes a little bit more. So do recommend.
I highly recommend our sponsor at Espresso Warriors Katara.
Ooh, I'll have to try it, definitely.
So what is inattentional blindness?
So inattentional blindness, it's a fancy, complicated term. Well, it sounds like it's going to be complicated, but it's basically just looking without seeing. So when we look around in the world, we think we're seeing everything that there is out there to see, but actually we're only seeing what we're focusing attention on. So inattentional blindness is when we fail to notice things that are unexpected, and they might be right in front of us, and we don't see them because our attention is on something else at the time. So if, for example, you're studying and maybe you're looking at your computer, you could have a friend waving to you, you know, saying, you know, hello, I'm here, and you might not even notice them at all.
And what causes inattentional blindness?
So inattentional blindness, the theory around it is that we have a limited attentional capacity. So I like to think of attention as being like a fuel tank, where you can only use so much of it before your resources become depleted. So if you used up all your fuel, it means that you're going to be unable to notice other things that are outside of the focus of your attention. So it's generally believed that the more attentional resources a task is consuming, the less likely we're going to be to notice something unexpected. If the task is quite easy or not very demanding, we should be able to perceive other things in our field.
And how can it impact an eyewitness?
So there's pretty limited research into how this process relates to witnesses' experiences and their memory. But some of the work I did in my PhD suggests that inattentional blindness might actually be quite bad for witnesses, because you can imagine if you didn't notice part of a crime, or maybe you didn't see it happen at all, you're not going to be that useful for police. But also what we found is that it could make witnesses more suggestible. So it could make them more likely to report on incorrect details that they might have been exposed to afterwards. So, you know, something that they heard from another witness or something they read in the media. So it can actually be it can have a profound effect on their memory, which is quite surprising.
And you did your PhD research into the disappearance of William Tyrrell and why no witnesses have come forward. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so my research was inspired by that case. When I started working in eyewitness memory research, I had to look into the literature and see what was there. And one thing I noticed about all of the research that's done in this field is that participants in these studies know that they're going to see a crime. That's part of how we have to advertise these studies to participants. And there's ethical reasons for that. We need participants to give informed consent so that they know exactly what they'll be doing. But what that means is that we're already making the assumption that witnesses will notice crimes when they happen and that they will be able to remember them. And so when it came to the William Tyrrell case, I was interested in whether the reason no witnesses came forward is because they just weren't aware what they had witnessed was a crime. And this is pretty typical of kidnapping cases, where children might go willingly with a stranger. So they don't show those stereotypical signs of struggle or things we'd associate with a kidnapping. So we did some research where we manipulated whether the crime was really obvious to participants. So we had a child that was, you know, screaming for help and bystanders were all concerned and running around. And then we had another version where the child went willingly with the adult. And what we found was that there were differences in whether our participants reported that event as a crime, and there were differences in how that affected their memory as well. So wow. It seems that our interpretation of what's happening in front of us, whether we think it's something serious or whether we think it's a crime, actually does affect memory.
Mm. So I guess to kind of like draw a parallel, when Daniel Morcombe went missing, he was taken from a bus stop on a really busy highway in Queensland. So I suppose that seeing a young boy walking with an older male just would have seemed normal.
Yeah, exactly. So the Daniel Morcombe case also has some similarities. There was also a case a few years ago in a shopping centre where a child was taken by a stranger in the play area and nobody blinked an eye. They just thought it was a normal occurrence. And because of that, because we don't perceive those events as serious, it's likely that we don't really we don't really take the time to remember them. We don't process them in a lot of detail, and we don't think about them. I mean, if you've witnessed a crime, it's probably going to be on your mind a lot. You'll tell a lot of people about it. You'll think about it at night. If it was something you didn't interpret as a crime, you're not going to have that same rehearsal process. So you're unlikely to remember it in any good detail. Mm.
Yeah, and I guess people aren't really kind of looking out for crime all the time. Yeah. No.
Especially in Australia, it's not particularly common that you're going to see a crime on the street. So it's not fitting in with your expectations of the world.
Mm. When just after Daniel Morcombe's disappearance, they placed a mannequin on the side of the road at the bus stop, and there's hardly any recollection of that mannequin being there, let alone Daniel leaving with this man. It's a different experience being an eyewitness when you're a civilian and when you're a police officer. Can you talk about that and how inattentional blindness comes into that?
Yeah, so I mean, when we think about the work that police do, they experience crime on a daily basis, they respond to crime, it's part of their mental framework of what happens in the world. So they have it's not an unrealistic, overestimation of crime, but it's just through the nature of their work, they get exposed to it a lot more. So that might lead to differences in how they would recall criminal events and how they report about them. There's some research in this field, it's a bit mixed. There's some findings that suggest that police officers are more observant than civilians. There's some research that suggests there's really no differences. And the implication for police when they experience inattentional blindness is that they're generally going to be under a lot of stress with their jobs. And what that means is that their attention is already likely to be restricted. So it is actually possible that they might be more likely to experience inattentional blindness. And I've done some surveys with police that suggest that they are concerned that this might happen to them, and that when they're, you know, at a really busy crime scene and they're focusing on, you know, one person at the scene or talking to someone, that there could be other really dangerous things that happen around them. So they might be at a heightened risk of experiencing it.
It's not uncommon for victims and offenders to know each other. How does inattentional blindness affect that?
So the effect that that is likely to have on not necessarily a witness's memory, but it's going to have an effect on how that witness might be perceived. So there was a case in America of a police officer who claimed that he experienced inattentional blindness. So police officers were called to the scene of a crime. It was relatively late at night in a park, and there were different police officers in Boston that all responded to this event. And one of the police officers wasn't dressed in uniform because he had been undercover. And he was pursuing the suspect of this crime. Another police officer was also pursuing the suspect. And the police officer that was in uniform was chasing the suspect over a fence. And as he was doing that, other officers mistook this undercover officer as the perpetrator and engaged in quite a brutal assault of this police officer. And the police officer who was chasing after was right there. He was, you know, 8 or so meters away from this assault, but he claimed that he didn't see it. And the issue with his testimony, I mean, we can't know for sure whether he was lying or not, but there was the perception that he must be lying because these police officers that committed the assault were known to him. They were all part of the police force. There might have been some motive for him to lie. Mm. So it's likely that if we claim that we didn't see something and we know the defendant or the person who's been accused, jurors might interpret that as a reason for someone to lie and be perjuring themselves. So there could be some really serious criminal charges for the witness themselves.
Mm. So you've made it clear that lots of people within law enforcement are aware of inattentional blindness. Why is it so that witnesses are expected to accurately call each detail if so many people are aware of this?
Yeah, I would say the awareness is not quite there. I mean, there are police officers that when you survey them, they report on this as being an experience that they have. I guess the expectation is that we assume that something as serious as a crime is going to be noticed. That's just an assumption that we all make. We think that, you know, if a witness was right there, they were looking right at it, that they should have seen what happened. And there's a lot of examples of this in TV shows. There's an example of Grey's Anatomy where a surgeon is accused of lying or being deceptive when they said they didn't see something. You know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine has some really great examples of it too. So we make these assumptions, they're in popular culture, they're all around us. So the assumption is probably going to be that if a witness isn't forthcoming with information, that all they need to do is press them a little bit more or ask more direct questions in order to get some information. And so that's why we see that despite the fact that police officers generally know that, you know, the visual experience is limited and that people might not notice things, they might still put pressure on these witnesses to give information. And that might be what causes these memory issues for the witnesses.
How has your research helped address the shortcomings in the criminal justice system?
Well, I'd like to hope it's had some kind of impact, but I guess it's hard when you work in a university and you're divorced from working directly with industry or working with police directly. There can be some resistance of uptake to research that's conducted at university, and particularly because the work that we do, there are some limitations to it in terms of we can't replicate the exact circumstances around crimes. It's not ethical to do it, and it's just not practical. But I'd like to think that the work that we've done has helped police. It's also, you know, we've talked to lawyers as well about this and gotten their views of it. So we're hoping to have a bit more engagement with these different industries. But we've also been in discussion with police forces about the phenomenon and just trying to hopefully get to a point where we could do some training just to make it more common knowledge that this does happen to witnesses and police officers.
Yeah, it's definitely a super interesting area, and I'm sure it's sparked a lot of interest with our listeners. How can other people get involved in this area?
Well, I'd love for people to come if they want to work with me, do some volunteering. I'm always happy to respond to emails and talk with interested students and non-students as well. I think everyone has something useful to contribute. I think if you're interested in forensic psychology generally, there are some really great university groups that do some cool research. So University of Newcastle here, but also University of Sydney, UNSW, and beyond New South Wales as well. I think another thing that listeners can do is just keep up to date with what's happening in the legal field. So podcasts like this are really great. Other podcasts, just keeping up to date with the news, because a lot of the work that we do in forensic psychology research is inspired by real cases, like William Tyrrell's case, like Daniel Morecambe, and like some of the cases we're seeing emerging more recently as well. So keeping up to date, just being aware of the limitations of, you know, the visual system, memory, and keeping that in mind, because another thing is you never know when you'll be called for jury duty. And having a little bit of awareness of some of these things could actually be really good for generally making sure justice is achieved.
Is there anything you'd like to add, Hayley?
I don't think so. I've had a really great time. So awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you,
Isabella.
So much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the UON Crim podcast, run by the Criminology and Criminal Justice Society at the University of Newcastle and sponsored by Espresso Warriors Katara. A special thank you to Corey DiPasquale for composing the podcast theme music, to Tamika Hillebrand, Ryan Crew, Sabina Hudson, and Shay Kleinian for their administrative assistance and support. Please like the UON CCJS on Instagram and Facebook. I'm your host, Isabella Krebet, and I'll be back with another episode in 2 weeks.